Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you this afternoon. I am sure loving this. And if you have any ideas for a name for my new show, I am taking offers. You can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. I will send you one of those coffee shop gift cards. I won't have any actual money on it, but it's kind of nice to get a card. Kind of exciting. All right. Happy birthday to Vice President Mike Pence. He's 59 today. And happy birthday to Prince. If he was alive, he'd be celebrating 60. Prince would be 60 today if he was still alive. Now, you got to be careful when you brag to anybody about your athletic accomplishments because you just never know who you're talking to. So if you say, hey, I just had 11,000 steps on my Fitbit, and you said that to Ben LeCompte, he is a Frenchman that is decided to swim across the Pacific Ocean. Does it sound like I just made that up? He's going to swim across the Pacific Ocean, 5,500-mile trip. He's going to swim for 8 hours a day, and he's got a yacht or a 67-foot boat that will drop him off in the water and then follow him, and then he'll eat and sleep on that. But he will swim across the Pacific Ocean. It's amazing the capacity of the human being and what people are capable of doing. That's a crazy endeavor. Anyway, I find that fascinating. All right, Dr. Bruce Ashford is going to be with us in just a minute. He's written a book that is great summer reading. It's called Letters to an American Christian. And he's going to talk about his book and some other tidbits along the way. So we'll take a short break and then bring on Dr. Bruce Ashford. Be back in a minute.
Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future.
For the past 69 years, Faith Radio has stood the test of time. Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. In February of next year, AM 900 in the Twin Cities will celebrate 70 years of broadcasting the good news of Jesus Christ. From that humble beginning, the Faith Radio Network has grown to 8 markets with 12 AM and FM signals and more on the way. One owner, one message, 69 years of relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching, thanks to God's faithfulness and thousands of generous listeners through the years, including you. Would you join me in praying for Faith Radio's future? We believe that God has called us to serve Him for such a time as this, and your prayerful partnership is needed and appreciated. If you're not already a member of our monthly support team, would you consider joining? $30 a month is a great way to start your support of this ministry. You can sign up to be a member of Team 360 by visiting our website at myfaithradio.com.
We're back at 7 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. I have Dr. Bruce Ashford on the studio line. He is the dean of, he's the provost of at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, where he serves as professor of theology and culture. And he's been a regular guest on the show. I'm always glad to have him back. Hello, Bruce.
Bill, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me back.
What exactly is provost? I thought provost was the wine steward at a French restaurant.
Well, provost actually is... a good translation in the Latin is, may I refresh your coffee, Mr. President, and also polish your shoes.
Exactly.
But interestingly, provost is a Latin word that actually used to refer to a prison warden. And there's lots of jokes to be made there.
Oh, yeah. Bring them on. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I might refrain.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, you've been busy. I know you've got a lot on your plate, and school has wrapped up, but you've written a new book, which just recently came out. I think June 1st was its release date, and I love talking about it because I think summer reading I have a hard time staying focused for very long. And this book you can pick up and put down and pick up and put down and learn all kinds of stuff. It's called Letters to an American Christian, and tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so you're right. It is written for beach reading or to be read in an easy chair. It is a series of 26 very short letters written to a hypothetical college student who's just become a Christian. and is trying to figure out how to shape his social, cultural, and political views in light of the Bible. And I'm coaching him to avoid the secular progressivism of his professors and some of the crazy beliefs of his family. And really, I'm just trying to help all of us who are Christians right now try to figure out how to stand out as a witness right now in our very trying times. And I think if we will cut a wake of faithfulness, that we'll be different. We'll stick out like an Amish kid with a nose ring, you know.
People right.
That we're a little bit different.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about the book. I want to pick out some chapters and have you discuss just as a tease. I highly recommend the book, but this is obviously a family-friendly show. Chapter one is entitled No Public Nudity, Please.
Yeah, so that's a play off of a theory. There's a Harvard professor, John Rawls, a former professor at Harvard named John Rawls, who is known for having a theory that's often called the naked public square theory, where he argued that religion is like clothing that a person wears and that we should take the clothing off before we come to the public square because it's tacky to basically wear your religion in a public conversation, all right?
Yeah.
And so what I want to argue is that religion is not like clothing. You know, it can't be taken on and off. Religion is more like your heart. And in fact, the Bible relates religion to the heart more than 800 times. And a person's religion is, if you want to find it, if you want to find their God, you find whatever they've made absolute or ultimate in their life. It could be the God of Jesus Christ. It could be sex or money or power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the religion right there. And whatever it is going to radiate outward into everything we do, including our politics.
Mm-hmm.
We can't stop it from coming out.
Well,
and so the book is written from that perspective, that our Christianity can and should influence the way we think about public matters.
Mm-hmm. I think in Scripture where it says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, I think that word in the Greek is the word kardia, which means love the Lord your God with the decisions you make.
Absolutely.
So how do you walk into the public square, Bruce, and not have your religion be part of that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, another good verse is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we fear the Lord, then his saving works and his saving word will give us wisdom.
Yeah.
Wisdom to know how to speak to free speech.
Yeah.
Or religious liberty or socialism or even constitutional interpretation.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. Now, newer Christians might not understand fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, so when the Bible talks about the fear of the Lord, it's not really talking about being frightened of him because he's a bad guy who's going to hurt you. It's talking about a healthy and deep and abiding respect for God. You know, it would be a fearful thing if God appeared to us all of a sudden. We would all of a sudden respect him a little more than we did, would want to listen to what he had to say and do what he wants us to do. And the Bible's just saying, listen, God is God. He's a cosmic king of the universe. Respect him that way.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good king. You don't have to fear him in a bad way. You fear him in a good way.
Yeah. All right. Let's look at chapter 3, Bruce. It said, Jesus is Lord and Congress is not. I would also like to add, comma, and neither is the SCOTUS.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Jesus is Lord and Congress is not. Supreme Court is not.
Right.
President is not.
Right.
The political parties are not. And the point here is just this, that the Bible teaches that God created the world through Jesus. He's the king of the world. When he brings us to salvation, when he forgives us of our sins and adopts us, he also sends us out as ambassadors of his. We're ambassadors of the king. And the Bible teaches that Jesus is going to return one day, and when he returns, he's going to institute basically a one-world government and a one-party system with him at the head of it, and it'll be a situation in which justice rolls down like the waters. There'll be peace and order and justice and flourishing and delight, all of the things that we want right now, but we can never quite achieve them. And so Jesus is Lord, and Congress is not. And we need to remind ourselves of that. And I think a related truth is that if Jesus is Lord, then the book that he revealed to us, the Bible, the story of the world that is told in the Bible is more important than the story that's told on any cable news network.
Yeah, that's so true.
By any political party.
Yeah. All right, let's pick another one, if you don't mind. How about let God be true and every ideology a liar?
Basically, in that chapter, what I showed is that modern political ideologies, all of them, tend to be idolatrous. Now, what does the word idolatrous mean? That's a big professor word. I'm a big nerd.
Yeah.
The Bible teaches that an idol...
Not arguing with that one.
Thank you for your support.
Yeah, you got it.
So the Bible teaches that human beings, what we tend to do is we tend to take things that God created and worship those things as God instead of worshiping God himself. And it could be sex or money or power, or some people actually worship things that they've made with their hands, a golden calf in the Bible, that kind of thing. But political ideologies can elevate something to the position of God. Socialism elevates material equality to the position of a God. It trumps everything else. The desire for material equality becomes a club that beats down other good aspects of God's creation.
Mm.
Classical liberalism makes a God out of liberty and a bad definition of liberty, freedom from all restraints, all moral restraints, all social norms. Conservatism, if it's divorced from Christianity, elevates cultural heritage to the point of being a God. And will even affirm aspects of our cultural heritage that are not good.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs Christianity to enter in and help it be its best self. Nationalism, ethno-nationalism, take that, is the elevating of one ethnic group as superior in comparison to other ethnic groups in a country.
Mm-hmm.
So all these ideologies tend to make an idol out of something, and as Christians, this is our opportunity to point out the idol and to point out that the idol is not God.
Mm, well said. Now, Bruce, if you were Satan, and I know you're not.
Thank you.
Wouldn't you want to make a statement that was 97% true and only 3% completely wrong?
Oh, yeah. Lies are always built on the back of truths.
Yeah.
It's the taking of truths and twisting them in the wrong direction. That's exactly right.
Because I think of the best way to completely contaminate someone's thinking and is through an ideology that sounds 97% true. But it's that big, tall glass of cold water that's got one drop of arsenic in it. Don't drink it.
That's a great point because, you know, every you know, an idol is actually a good thing that becomes bad when we make it a god. And so the different things that the different ideologies seek, like material flourishing or liberty, or these are good things that God created, but they become bad when we put them in, make them into a god.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, Bruce, you're not used to talking to me when I'm fully awake, are you?
Listen, this is dangerous. I don't know what to do with Bill Arnold fully awake. I'm used to talking to you at 6 o'clock in the morning.
I know. So let me take a quick break. When I come back, lots more with Dr. Bruce Ashford. If you have a question for Bruce, we'd be happy to take it. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Be back in a minute. It is 19 minutes after the hour. I am having a lovely conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford. And he has written a book called Letters to an American Christian, among other books that he's written. He's a busy guy. And we've got callers, Bruce. Should we take calls?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, let's talk to Dawn from Meriden, Connecticut. Hello, Dawn. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm just doing great. Thank you. Do you have a question
That's
or
awesome.
Comment for Bruce?
I do. A friend of mine has been very excited about something that they found on YouTube. And seems to be really into it. And I listened to this person on YouTube, and I immediately got this really bad feeling in my gut. And this person professes to be a Christian, and I told them that I don't feel that this is somebody that he should be listening to. And his name is Jordan Peterson. And I was wondering if you know about him or what your thoughts are on his teaching.
Yeah, that's a good question. So Jordan Peterson has all of a sudden in the past few months become a household name in the United States, Canada, and Europe. And you're right that he is not, in many ways, he is not one of us. He is a person who is a secular, if you will, who is saying a number of things that are very similar to what Christians would say. And because he's in the social sciences, he gets a hearing in a way that we don't. And so his thought, it is a mixed bag. There's going to be some things we agree with, some things we don't agree with, and you've got good wisdom and discernment to warn people to listen with a critical ear.
Thank you so much, Don. Yeah, anything else on that?
No, it was just when you had said that 97% truth with the 3% lie, that was the first thing that popped into my head, because this is exactly what I was trying to explain to this person. You know, and they're a relatively new Christian in the last couple of years, and, you know, I've been walking with Jesus for over 40 years.
Mm.
You know, so I've sat under a few pastors, Bible teaching, you know, myself. So when some of the things were said, I'm like, oh, no.
And,
I
think a very discerning comment, because I think the tendency right now in the States, it sometimes is to find a commentator of some sort and then almost slavishly follow everything they say without listening critically, which is what you're suggesting to do. And I agree with you.
Yeah, Don, great call. Really, thank you for calling and sharing that.
Thank you very much for your answer.
Yeah. See what I mean, Bruce? We have very smart callers.
Yeah, you do. That was fun.
Yeah. All right. How about this chapter? Nobody throws a tantrum like a politically correct American.
Yeah. So that chapter is where I tackle political correctness and say something like this. The tolerance movement, ironically, is very intolerant.
Yes.
Because members of the tolerance movement, for them, truth is subjective. It's not absolute. So you have your truth and I have mine. And what that means is when I disagree with you, you've identified truth with who you are, your truths with who you are as a person. And so if I disagree with you, you view it as an attack on you, right? So when we disagree with people, it's called hatred, bigotry, and phobia. So let's talk about, just really quickly, political correctness. The phrase actually comes from the Soviet Union. There was a joke that went around. Where the Soviet citizens were kind of making fun of their political regime. And the joke was this, where one guy says, "Comrade, your statement is factually incorrect." And the other one says, "Yes, it is, but it is politically correct." And the joke was just that everybody knows that there are certain things that are politically correct, but not factually correct.
Mm.
And what started as a Soviet joke has become a not very funny American reality. And what I argue is this. Political correctness causes people to hide their convictions under enormous social pressure. And that instead of political correctness, we need something that old Christians used to call way back in the day, civility, Christian civility. It's the opposite of political correctness. And instead of hiding our convictions under social pressure, we show our convictions, we speak hard truths, but we do it in a way that shows respect and even love for the other person. Now, that is very hard to do in our nation today. We've got a weaponized, tribalized, polarized public discourse. And what we're going to have to do as Christians is to learn to stand there in the moment, even if someone's lying about us, telling partial truths, mocking us, and insulting us. We're going to have to stand there in the moment and speak with that Jesus-like combination of truth and grace.
Mm-hmm.
Truth without grace makes us a political bully or a jerk. Grace without truth makes us a political wimp. Or a non-entity.
Yeah.
So like Jesus did and like Paul did, we got to combine those two things.
Yeah. Bruce, you have very, very catchy chapter titles. Did you write those?
I did.
Okay.
I did. They're all mine.
Cool.
I had fun with it.
They're very catchy. How about this one? No need for mullahs at 1 First Street. I don't even know what that means. Seriously, I went to junior college for 11 years and I have no idea what that means.
Well, you know, and that's why I'm here.
Okay,
And free. So one First Street is the location of the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. And a mullah, as you know, and as I think the listeners probably know, a mullah is basically a Muslim theologian and moralist.
Okay.
The point is that we don't need Supreme Court lawyers who have decided that their job is to be a moral philosopher or theology teacher for Americans. We need Supreme Court lawyers who interpret the Constitution the way that it was meant to be interpreted. They're not allowed to take things out of the Constitution they want to take out and insert things they want to insert. The Constitution is not a living document. If they want to change the Constitution and tell America, you know, tell Americans how we ought to live, what they think is moral or immoral, they don't have the right to do that. The Founding Fathers gave us a procedure for that, and we can change the Constitution. We can make an amendment to it, and that can only be done through the legislature, through people who are elected by the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to say that, you know, we the people are the ones who should give guidance to the moral direction of our country, rather than nine begowned Ivy League lawyers on the Supreme Court.
I'm with you. All right. Just 2.5 minutes left, Bruce, so hopefully that's enough time for this one. I've been saving what I think might be the best for last. In my opinion, recovering the lost art of Christian persuasion, I can't wait to hear about.
Okay. So, yeah, the early church, early Christians, you know, were surrounded by people who didn't believe what they believed. And early Christians thought that we needed to have we needed to follow the way of the closed fist and the way of the open hand. The way of the closed fist is when people attack Christianity, that we give very firm responses in defense. But the way of the open hand is when we're able to use warmth and wit and persuasion to pull people into the faith. And that's what we've got to recover. We have to learn how to find common ground with the people we disagree with, to show human warmth and love, and to reason with them in terms that they can appreciate and draw them into the faith instead of driving them away. I'm afraid that our tone and our way of reasoning with people can often push them away more than it draws them in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of what I want to aim for. It's kind of, you know, on your radio show, you use humor. And I think humor is really one of the prime ways to draw people in, especially if it can be self-deprecatory humor, right? Humor that's not at somebody else's expense.
Mm-hmm.
Imagination.
Well, yeah.
C.S. Lewis used his imagination.
Right. Well, all humor has a target, and when you make fun of yourself, you never run out of material.
Yeah, especially when it's me. And maybe you.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's actually fun. It's more fun, actually, to poke a little fun at yourself, I think.
Well, you know, there's nothing more painful than anyone who has an overblown sense of self-importance.
Oh, yeah, just a towering sense of self-approval. You know, usually people who have a towering sense of self-approval also are kind of breathtakingly ignorant, and they're trying to make up for something. And so we need to be careful that we're not that kind of person.
Right. Now, I recommend you highly to go to Bruce Ashford's website, bruceashford.net, and also to go buy his book that we've been discussing today. And you can do that at Amazon if you want. And you can find everything you need to know about Bruce on his website. Bruce, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Bill, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Yep. Have a great day. All right. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute.
I hate to play Captain Obvious, but for the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. George Orwell wrote that sometimes the first duty of intelligent men is the restatement of the obvious. So here it goes. A recent Atlantic Monthly article complained about the potential excesses of policing sex on campus. Take this story from the University of Cincinnati. Male and female student have a drunken hookup. He wakes up terrified she's going to file a sexual misconduct complaint, so he goes to the Title IX office and beats her to the punch. She's found guilty and suspended. The article rightly criticizes how easy it is to abuse Title IX, which mandates schools crack down on sexual assault. But missing in all this analysis is the obvious. Don't have drunken hookups. Follow this rule, Title IX doesn't matter. It's impossible to overstate how deeply the sexual revolution has reshaped our thinking, which leaves intelligent men and women with a whole lot of restating to do. For more on faith and culture, come to breakpoint.org. I'm John Stone Street.
Welcome back to the show. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you this afternoon. You know, when professionals cross disciplines, I believe you get the most fascinating results. My guest on our studio line is Dr. Kent Dunnington. He's the associate philosophy professor at Biola University, and he's written a book on addiction. It's called Addiction and Virtue, and it is, in my opinion, the holy grail of books on addiction. So, Kent, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Yeah, you know I'm a huge fan. I can hardly stand how excited I am to be having you on the show.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to know that. I don't know that this topic generally generates fans, but I'm glad to have a fan in you, Bill.
Well, it does generate fans. Dave Barry is my favorite comedy writer, and virtually every line he writes has got some piece of gold in it. And when I read your book, and I read it several times, every line in it has got something meaningful in it. I don't know how you did it. I got to tell you,
I appreciate that.
It's fascinating. It really is. And as we struggle in this day and age of addiction, and it's all across the board. They say you touch your phone 2,000 times a day. I mean, we've got addiction problems going serious all over the place. And I want to get into your brain a little bit today and talk about addiction and what it is and the whole model of addiction as a disease. Talk about that, if you would.
So the most prominent contemporary way of thinking about addiction is to think of it as a sort of disease. Not a sort of disease, that's actually a brain disease. That's the way that it's defined by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, defined as a chronic relapsing brain disease. And I don't think addiction is a disease. I can say a little bit about why I think the arguments in support of that claim fail, but I do think it's important to understand why the disease concept of addiction is so powerful, because it does resonate with the experience of many addicts that they have a kind of loss of control, a loss of power, loss of willpower in particular. And it feels like something more powerful than them is trying to destroy them. So it's helped many serious addicts feel understood. It's also, I think, helped remove the moral stigma that's so often associated with addiction. And that's a very good thing. I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also directed our attention to the biological dimensions of addiction. Just because something has biological dimensions doesn't make it a disease, of course. We're human beings. Everything about us has biological dimensions. But still, the disease understanding has helped us learn a lot about the biology of addiction. And then it's had some really practical benefits as well. It's helped us justify insurance coverage for addiction treatment, and I think that's good. But I don't ultimately think addiction is best understood as a disease. The arguments for it are pretty weak. I mean, the arguments are that drug use changes the brain. And, of course, almost everything that we do consistently changes the brain. Becoming a good cellist or becoming a good radio interviewer will change your brain in ways that we can discern on brain scans.
Are you listening to that brain? I'm talking to myself right now.
There's also an attempt to show that since there's a genetic predisposition in certain people to addictive behavior, therefore addiction is a disease. But that argument is pretty weak as well. We have genetic dispositions to all kinds of things. And I mean, people can be shown to have genetic dispositions to be more or less religious than other people, but mm-hmm. we don't want to say that being a religious person is a disease. So I don't think ultimately that the disease concept of addiction actually describes the phenomenon, but I do understand why it's been such a powerful concept.
Mm-hmm. When I think about the predisposed, I also wonder, how does the environmental circumstances play into that? If you grew up in a family where mom and dad were drinking every night and there were nothing but parties on the weekends, and you took your first sip of beer from a party that was going on in your parents' basement when you were 12, and that's how life kind of went about, is that a genetic predisposition?
Certainly not. I mean, so environmental factors are huge, and this is now the best set of experiments that has shown this, or a famous set of experiments called the Rat Park experiments. And there's a great addiction study specialist named Bruce Alexander who did these experiments where they took rats who they got addicted. If you believe rats can be addicted, that's a separate question. There's a distinction between dependence and addiction. But rats who were addicted to opiates in laboratory settings were then placed into what was a rat park. So they created an ideal environment, everything that a rat would want to be a happy rat. They put into this rat park, including other rats, places to play, places to rest, good things to eat. And the striking thing about it is that both that, and they made heroin in this case readily available to all the rats. The striking thing about it is that any kind of rat that they put in the rat park, whether it was a severely addicted or a non-addicted rat, within a short amount of time, all of them began to ignore the heroin and simply do the kinds of things that rats like to do. So it's clear that environment has a tremendous impact on whether or not a person becomes an addict. On the other hand, genetics matters. There are people who are genetically set up such that they could not become addicted to certain substances no matter the environment they're in. And then there are people who are genetically predisposed in such a way that if you put them in the wrong environment, the chances of them becoming addicted are extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complex interrelationship.
Yeah. If you would, Kent, talk a little bit about becoming addicted. I mean, isn't there a habit and a routine that starts and you start to get in a situation where it becomes the easy thing to do?
Yeah, my view is that addiction is best understood as a habit, and habits are things that we develop over time. Habits are always strategies. One of the most important things, I think, that both of the prominent contemporary models of addiction overlook is the fact that the reason people become addicted to things is because addiction helps people achieve certain things that they want to achieve in their lives. And it's not just the experience of pleasure. In fact, if you read the biographies, the memoirs of seriously addicted persons, say if you just read the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, almost without fail, the initial experiences that people have with their drug of choice is an experience of certain goods that philosophers would call moral goods or even intellectual goods that they have found otherwise very difficult to find in their life. The most prominent one is a sense of belonging. So over and over again, addicts will talk about how their lives were plagued by loneliness and disconnection. And a drug of choice suddenly makes them feel like they belong to the human race, like they're accepted. And you can imagine how habits can build around substances or practices that allow us to achieve those sorts of things. And so I think the reason you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that we're surrounded by addiction, and it's true, there's simply no reason to think that previous societies experienced anything like the levels of addiction that we have. And the question is why. And I think it's a combination of two things. One, there's the structure of modern life is such that it makes certain very important human goods hard to find. Two, we're in what my friend Anna Lemke, who's the director of addiction medicine at Stanford, calls a dopamine rainforest. So we are surrounded now more than ever before by practices and substances that provide an immediate access to those goods that our society is starving us for. And so once you have something that will give you access to those goods, you begin to use it to satisfy those needs, and you develop habits and such that anytime you're in need of companionship or a sense of purpose in life or a sense of unity in life, you have something you know that can provide that, if only in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
This is incidentally why in the book I talk about addicts as unwitting prophets, and a lot of people have responded to that description because it seems like I'm praising addicted persons. I mean, I'm not. It's not like they're intending to be prophets, but they do, like prophets do, point to serious problems in our culture, and so we need to listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Ken, in your book, you make a brilliant observation of the way the brain is rewired through abuse, and I can certainly believe that could happen, of course, but talk about the cellist. Now, the cellist, after decades of practicing the cello, their brain has somehow rewired, so that's what they know how to do. So is that something they do, or is that something they're suffering from?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in my view, it's sort of a combination. This is why habit is such a helpful category for thinking about human action, because we often tend to think in those binary terms, so that everything I do is either something that I do as an autonomous, voluntary, entirely free agent, as though I'm poised between two alternatives and exert my will freely to choose one or the other on the one hand, or on the other hand, as though everything we do, we suffer. We're simply sort of the pawn of various forces around us. I think, in fact, that almost everything that we call human behavior is neither of those things. Most of the things that we call human behavior is a function of habit. And habit is a disposition. It's the way in which, through practice, through repetition, we shape our brains and everything our brains controls, from our appetites to our emotions to our imaginations. We shape those things to make certain actions more obvious and easier than others. So, you know, to just give an example, I've been watching the NBA championships, and you can watch LeBron James pass the basketball. And what he does in the split second is so fast, he couldn't possibly be processing it all and sort of choosing from a range of equally available options what to do. No, he's acting habitually, we might even say instinctively. Nevertheless, he's not being determined or controlled by something outside of him. So I think addictive behavior is very much like that. It is something that we do, but it's not an autonomous free choice in the way that we tend to think about some kinds of human action.
Mm-hmm. Ken, talk a little bit about the paradox of addiction. That's like when the addicted person claims to be powerless over their addictive behavior, yet this admission itself is the inroad to regaining power over that same behavior.
Yeah, that's one of the most perplexing things about addiction, and it's really captured in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous, famously, the first step says we began by admitting that we are powerless over addiction. But of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is itself a program where an addict, through no medical intervention or anything like that, comes to be able to exert control over their addictive behavior. And so I think, in fact, it is a simplification of a much more complex truth. I mean, literally, addicts are not powerless over their behavior. There are all kinds of studies that show that addicts are sensitive to rewards in much the same way that that non-addicts are. But what I think the mantra reveals is that the pure exertion of willpower is going to be insufficient to help an addict overcome their addiction. If that's the only tools in your repertoire, then you will end up being powerless. And so the brilliance of Alcoholics Anonymous is a really common sense one. It's simply the recognition that the only thing that can overcome addictive patterns and habits is the meticulous construction of a new set of patterns and habits that can replace them. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs say the point here is not to stop drinking. The point is to learn to live sober. That is to say, to become a person who's differently habituated in the world. If you just set out to stop drinking and you try to white knuckle it, the evidence is just really good that you're going to fail. And it's in that sense that addicted persons are powerless over their substance, mm-hmm. the practice of choice.
Yeah. Kent, let me take a very short break. I'm speaking to Dr. Kent Dunnington. His book, Addiction and Virtue, I've read it many times, and I think it's just one of the best books I've read on addiction. If you have a call or a question, 877-933-2484. I know this is a complicated subject, but we do have time for one call, and I've got lots of questions for Kent when we get back. Be back in a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour, the board is lighting up just like the dash on my car. Kent, I want to, before I get to some of the callers, I want to ask a question that my cousin, Dr. Katie Kranz, sent me. And she said, first of all, let Kent know that a chemist and a social worker used his book in a colloquium. It was well received. How about that?
No, great.
Yeah,
that's
I don't even know what colloquium means. Is that the ability to read underwater, or is that aquarium? I'm all confused.
That's just a fancy academic word for getting together and talking.
What is with you academics? Anyway, she said that today we live in a kind of a crisis on many levels, increased addiction. She said, how can the church be a key stakeholder in helping those who are disconnected? There's so much disconnection and isolation. What kind of solutions can the church offer?
It's a great question. And one of the questions that really prompted my interest in this topic was way back when I was in graduate school, because I had a mentor who had been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous for many years. He invited me once to go with him. And one of the things that struck me with a great deal of force on my first visit, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous or its history, was the kinds of practices that they were engaging in reminded me of what I had experienced as a young boy in a very conservative but extremely legalistic and fundamentalist, but very serious church setting, a setting that was almost modeled on some of John Wesley's sort of accountability group thinking. And the radical honesty, the confessional posture, the unconditional love and support, I mean, these were things that reminded me of the church at its best. And so one of the questions that I had and have continued to have throughout my whole study of addiction is, what does the church have to learn from Alcoholics Anonymous? And really, what does the church have to offer to addicted persons? You know, I think one of the reasons that folks in the church are scared to talk about addiction is because, and we're afraid to admit this, but I think we often worry that the gospel is not powerful enough to help people be rescued from addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at a point I was working in inner city Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, and we had a lot of crack addicts who were showing up at the church. And I experienced this sense of, you know, what do we really have to offer these folks? I mean, is a sermon on a Sunday morning going to do the trick for them? And I think the short answer is no. And so the church, I think, has to learn how to be a relational community of radical honesty. And one of the things that I always ask myself now whenever I've moved to a new place and look for a church is this a church that at any time a severely addicted person could come here and feel okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
great point.
That means it's going to need to be kind of a messy place. I just got done teaching a semester-long course on addiction to a bunch of students, and one of the requirements was that they went to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and reported back. And without fail, they talked about some of the crazy conversations, the tears, the kind of roller coaster ride that is an AA meeting. And I think the church has to learn to get comfortable with the kind of with the topsy-turvy experience that comes when people start getting really honest about their addictions. And until you have a church that's ready to do that, you really don't have anything to offer.
Mm-hmm. Kent, I know as we're just talking about really the philosophy of addiction and what addicted behavior looks like, I have gotten some calls of coming in, and I know you're not an addictions counselor, but I have another question for you, which might tie into one of the questions that came in. If you're flirting with an addiction, or you think you are addicted with an abuse, or you're abusing substance, what should I do? Or what if I'm living with someone who is? What if someone has an addiction problem and it's maybe ruining their marriage because it's something like porn?
Yeah, good. So I'll say a couple words first about what should you do if you think you may have an addiction problem. I think it depends on the severity. I mean, addiction is something that comes in degrees. But if you have a severe addiction, you need to seek help. You need to go to a 12-step group. I hope some of us have good enough churches that we could find help there. Many of our churches aren't nearly honest enough to help people recover from addiction. Many of them are places where people can go to pretend to be healthy or well, and that's no place for a person who is struggling with an addiction. So I still think that 12-step programs are the most invaluable resource for people who are worried that they may be slipping into addictive patterns. Just go and share that with the people in those meetings. You'll discover an incredible resource of wisdom and support. If you're with someone who is addicted, or who you suspect is addicted, it's very complicated. I think there's no magic bullet. I'll just offer a comment based on my experience with 12-step programs. What to me is amazing about 12-step programs when they're working well is this incredible combination between unconditional acceptance on the one hand and relentless honesty on the other. And those two things don't often go in hand. You think of parents who say to their child, you know, you've lied to us too many times. You can't come back to this house anymore. We have to wash our hands of you, so on and so forth. 12-step
mm-hmm.
programs never say that you aren't welcome. You can fail every day for 50 straight years, and you're welcome every night to start over and try to get your one-day sober chip. But then, so that's a kind of unconditional acceptance. But now think about people you know who tend towards unconditional acceptance. Often, they don't want to say hard things to other people. They want to take it easy. They want to put a good spin on things, let people get away with excuses. You don't find that in AA either. Recovering addicts can see right through self-deception and denial and pity parties and all the things that addicts are prone to, and they'll call you on it. They'll say, you never get sober lying like that. You need a sponsor. You know, let us know when you're ready to get serious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the combination between unconditional acceptance and relentless honesty is what is the posture that you need to learn to develop to be helpful to addicted persons. And that's something that just takes practice.
All right, Kent, we only have about 2.5 minutes left, and I don't know if I have time to put a caller on, but she did have a note that her daughter relapsed after 12 years, meth user, and she's kind of at wit's end. I know you're not an addictions counselor, but what would be your first response to this dear soul?
Yeah, it's so hard. And, you know, it depends so much on the kind of relationship that this person has. I would have to know more about the situation. I think the only big picture advice I would give is never break off communication. Try to understand that the person is not seeking to harm you, is not seeking to destroy the family or his or her relationships. And to try to find a way to keep the conversation going, to absolutely support this person in any way that they see fit to seek help.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I've got.
That's awfully great advice. And Kent, I got to say, the one mistake I made was only booking you for a half hour because the phone lines have just lit up. And I guess what I'll just have to do is have you back. If you don't mind.
Gladly.
We only have like a minute left. And one of the things I want to ask is with recreational drug use, I mean, marijuana is becoming legal all over. That is not a good trend, is it?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. And I honestly, I don't know. It's very complex in terms of economics, in terms of race. Is deeply implicated in the legalization of marijuana. I honestly don't know what the right policy is on that.
Yeah.
I do think that apart from that, there's a question that Christians often have, which is it okay for me to use marijuana? I do have some thoughts on that,
yeah,
but
we'll
I don't
have,
know if we
we'll
have time for that.
No, we're actually out of time. Kent, thank you so much, Dr. Kent Dunnington. That wraps up our show. Have a great night, everyone. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.